and welcome to another episode of the Healthcare Executive Insights Podcast. My name is Elliot Sloan with the McCallum Group. Today, we are very excited to have Mr. Josh Watts, who is the founder and board member of MedTrust Holdings. Josh, thank you so much for taking time to chat with us today.
No, thank you so much. I'm looking forward to it.
Yeah, it's our pleasure. So tell me a little bit about your professional background and then what led you to create MedTrust Holdings.
So my professional background was not directly related to our business. I graduated from Clemson University and went into a position recruiting for Lockheed Martin with a staffing firm called Aerotech, and really a great job to be 22 years old and around airplanes all day, and really exciting until September 11th happened. Wow. And after September 11th, all of my contractors got to go overseas and work tax-free. So kind of transitioned within Aerotech into their environmental division. And that allowed me some flexibility location-wise and got me to Charleston, South Carolina. So I moved down here in about 2002 and met my now wife, who was in healthcare. She was in medical sales and talked me into doing the same, and got into pharmaceutical sales. Originally thought it was really truly about the patient and about, you know, the medication and all those things. And unfortunately, learned that a lot more of that business was about samples and lunch. And so it wasn't exactly what I thought it was going to be. And but it was golden handcuffs. You know, I mean, it was a position that paid you well to deliver lunch and samples, and, you know, kind of had to figure out what kind of alternative might make sense. And one day I was at a lunch for a doctor's office, and she said something that literally I walked out the door and quit. I called my boss, and then I called my wife, who told me I was crazy. And in driving back from Myrtle Beach to Charleston, had to get a plan together. And that was about 2004.
You said something interesting, which is that two-thirds, at least in Georgia, of the EMS ambulance services are private, which would mean the hospitals are contracting out. Why is that?
Actually, it's South Carolina, but yes.
South Carolina.
Yes. So 911, the mission of 911 is what they call pre-hospital care.
Yeah.
So these are people that are calling from their home, calling from a doctor's office, et cetera, that need to get to the emergency room.
Sure.
Their mission is not interfacility, which is moving people in between buildings. So in fact, one of the ways that we describe what we do is we're the medicine between the buildings. And so we move patients either to a higher level of care because they're at a facility that doesn't offer what they need. We sometimes move patients for convenience. They are trying to get closer to home, closer to family, whatever. And then we also discharge patients from the hospitals. So moving patients out, moving patients in, that's the business we're in. And in South Carolina, it's about 110 private ambulance services in the state. And the vast majority of those have less than 7 ambulances. I think there's probably 15 ambulance services that have more than 10 ambulances. So wow. Very fragmented, very market specific. You know, so we're the largest South Carolina based private ambulance service. And we cover many of the major metros, you know, in South Carolina. And we do that generally because of a major hospital relationship.
And you said that you were backing up some of these hospitals,
right?
And the volume wasn't extremely over demanding, but right. Then you landed these two contracts where you became the premier provider for those hospitals.
Right. So, you know, for lots of regulatory reasons, a hospital can have an exclusive relationship. Obviously, they've got to be able to call other folks, but the agreements we have are called preferred agreements or first call agreements.
Sure.
So when we were backing up hospitals, it was
just the overflow work.
It was the overflow work. When we were backing up hospitals before, it was either because they had their own what they call hospital-based system, which is very prevalent in the Northeast, or they didn't have their own hospital system. They had another contractor or contracted provider, and we were the second call or third call in those cases. So that's what it looked like when we started, and not very predictable, not very easy to schedule around, but it was our way to get the experience initially.
Sure. And then you landed these two contracts. You went from 40 employees to 40 ambulances in 1 year.
Right. Yeah. So we went from, doing 600, 700 transports a month to doing 2,500 transports a month in 1 year.
That's 4X.
Yeah. Yeah. And this is a very capital intensive business. I mean, our equipment's expensive. Every ambulance is $130,000 to $150,000 before you put anything in it.
Wow.
And then you have, $20,000 stretchers and $30,000 heart monitors and all those things. And so thankfully my partner with her background, had had a lot of experience in fundraising and, going to market and things like that. But we were very conscious of who the investors were. So it was very much, friends and family or extended friends and family sort of, rounds, accredited investors, Reg B offerings. And we were very fortunate. I mean, when we raised money the first time, we had a great presentation about what we were going to do. Subsequently, we raised money two more times, and they were all about, this is what we've already done, those things we told you about last time, plus these four other things. And so it was easy is not the word, but it was very different the first time raising money and then having a track record. From 2017 to 2019, that was kind of our super hyper growth period. We raised money each year, but we were raising money for things we had won. So there were contracts that were signed and, performas produced. And,
at that point, you don't really need to even provide equity to an investor. You just need a lending partner, a debt partner.
Well, no, debt in our industry is really tricky because it's a very low margin business. And so, equity was the right way to go for 17, 18, and 19 because we were doing a hockey stick in a non-hockey stick industry that's very capital intensive. And so, one of the problems in healthcare is that your revenue is like the tide. The tide goes out, you put in all this money, and then it takes a while for the tide to come back in.
Sure.
And we had not paused yet. So we were just, at a rocket ship sort of pace, which meant that you were always behind from that P&L perspective. So debt was difficult. People don't understand healthcare from a lending perspective, especially not rapid growth healthcare. Sure. So equity was the way that we went. Primarily, we did a little bit of creative, private lending, but for the most part, it was equity for the first three raises.
Got it. Well, it sounds like you had a really good partner to steer those opportunities.
Yeah, she knew the she's an attorney with a great resume. She knew the proper way to do those things from a compliance perspective. And I'm the out front guy still. I mean, even though it's a different partner, that's still my role. And she's, been excellent in all of the operational financial details to make it happen. I was the CEO of the company through this whole time. And then that kind of brings us to 2019, I guess. The end of 2019, we decided to make our first acquisition. And we purchased a company we had worked with for several years. And all I can say is don't buy a company 3 months before a pandemic. Really tricky timing. But with that purchase, it was kind of the end of our first strategic plan. And our goal was to be in three states at $15 million in revenue with at least six hospital contracts. And at the end of 2019, we were around $18 million in revenue. We were in three states and we had nine hospital contracts. So we kind of hit all that and we said, okay, let's press pause and relook foundationally at our systems, at our everything from accounting to charting to workflows. And
where
and,
are the gaps? Where we
When you grow that fast, things change. I mean, how you support that changes. And we're a very distributed business. So we were at that point in 13 different locations. And how do you support that? And how do you standardize appropriately, but also have an identity, you know, in each of those places?
How many staff members and clinicians did you need to support that volume?
So at that time, we were probably around 350, 360. Out of that, I'd say 300 of those were clinical staff, EMTs or paramedics, and the remainder were support staff, dispatch staff, and kind of executive leadership.
Sure.
And so we had a pause planned, and then COVID punched us in the face with a much longer pause. We had some business development things that were looking like late 2020, which was perfect, gave us 6 to 9 months to kind of settle in, let all of the cash flow regulate itself and kind of fund the next phase of growth. But hospitals weren't making decisions at that time. They weren't changing providers. They were in survival mode in a lot of ways. And so, you know, we really, in a lot of ways, lost a year and a half of our next strategic plan to COVID and saw at things that everyone else in healthcare is seeing, you know, drastic cost challenges on labor, drastic challenges on supply chain and supply costs, fuel related challenges, which are even worse today than they were then. Sure. But probably in mid 2021, it's like everybody woke up as far as the hospitals that we were having prior conversations with. And now we're kind of back on growth mode, I guess, which is challenging right now because our industry and a lot of healthcare, they're in a place that I've never seen in 10 years from a financial, you know, headwind perspective. And we're actually seeing a lot of failures of peers of other ambulance providers because the math is really hard to make work now. You know, labor costs have gone up 22%. Fuel has gone from $60,000 a month to $160,000 a month. And in healthcare, you can't raise prices. You know, it's not like Medicare is going to raise to match your cost increase.
They went down.
They didn't go down necessarily. I mean, the Medicare rate went up 5.1% for ambulance in January. Unfortunately, our costs went up 30%.
So initially, when you guys were developing the business, what were your most successful growth strategies? How did you get in front of hospitals? How did you get these meetings to have the chance to pitch your new modern services with more data, more reporting, more reliable, happier employees, all the great things that you've built in the foundation of the business? You still need those opportunities to talk to the purchasers at these hospitals. How did you get into those opportunities?
Well, our industry is so fragmented that except for some major cities, there's a lack of professionalism in the business. And so just by communicating and basic blocking and tackling, I hate to put it that way, but a lot of our competitors or not even competitors, but a lot of companies in the business, they don't actively market at all. You know, the marketing is the ambulance with the, you know, the name on the side. And so we've always been fairly active from a social perspective, although it's definitely been more impactful on the workforce side. than it has the client side, although a few things have come off of a Facebook post or a LinkedIn post or something like that. But a lot of it is just good old fashioned long sales cycle business development, where you find out where the pain is, generally at the lowest level. And if they're in enough pain, they'll tell you who above them makes the decision, and and kind of working our way up. So multi-level engagement is a big deal for us, you know, having a relationship all the way down from the hospital employees that are touching the patients to the C-suite. Yeah. And generally what we found with a hospital, it's relatively simple what they're trying to do with most of their relationships. They want to know how a relationship is going to help them save money. How's it going to help them make money? Yep. Or how's it going to help them manage risk?
Sure.
Those are the three things that really drive the decision. And so if we can speak to those three things in an articulate way, we have a pretty good track record with winning those things. Now, you don't win them all, but for the most part, we've focused on that and tried to stay out of some of the other methods that folks may use to get business. You know, we're very transparent, and we've got the data to back up what we do, and our clients have been amazing to be available to, you know, speak with other folks, as long as they're not competitors, speak with other folks about what we do for them. But as far as getting in front of them, there was no magic silver bullet. It was definitely doing the grind of who's actually affected by the current services, and are they happy? And if they're happy, then don't waste your time. There's plenty of people that aren't, you know, so identifying those and then working.
What are some of the things you have implemented to try to attract talented staff members for you had explosive growth.
Right.
And it was during a time where everyone's feeling staffing pains. How did you navigate that? How are you navigating that?
So EMS has always had staffing challenges. We just cover them up by having people working these crazy shifts. You know, if you ask the hospital what their headcount was for FTEs or full-time equivalents, they would be basing that on a 36 or a 40-hour week. You ask an EMS agency that, and they're basing it on a 48 or a 72-hour week. So chronically understaffed, you know, period, before COVID. During COVID, you know, this is a group of people that have an unbelievable passion for helping. And so it reminded me early on of a hurricane evacuation. It was adrenaline. It was, let's come together. But at some point, a year and a half later, you can't run at redline for a year and a half, you know, or 2 years. And so part of what we did before and definitely have done since probably June of 21, we made the decision at the executive level and with our board that I was going to transition from the CEO role to a founder role, which, you know, everybody asks, what the hell does that mean? What do you do as a founder? And I'll tell you, it's not wearing flip-flops and trading those in, trading the loafers in. But the areas that I really have always been passionate about are the cultural side and the passion for the company. And what we realized is early on, I was talking with everyone we were hiring. I was having those conversations. And as we got bigger and bigger and spread out and there were other things to do, I wasn't. And our retention changed and our turnover went up. And I'm not saying it was me, but what we were missing was during the interview process or even prior to that, who was telling the story? You know, who was saying why Med Trust? I mean, people that are qualified in this field have got loads of opportunities. They can get fired today and be working by the afternoon. I mean, it is that kind of world. And so I flipped it on its head. And in June, I basically tore apart our recruiting process and said, we need to have a conversation with people prior to an interview. And the conversation is one that I have most of the time. Our HR team sometimes has this, but most of the time it's me. And it's really to get to know them, what they're looking out of, you know, looking for, looking in the industry and what their future looks like. And then I take about 15, 20 minutes and give them a 50,000 foot view of who we are and why. And you know, from a scale perspective, I'm worried it's not scalable forever, right? But in this time especially, we have seen a big impact because people say, I've never talked to the founder ever in any interview process. It's HR, they're ticking some boxes. Do you have the certification? You know, what shift are you looking for? That kind of stuff. And then they talk to a hiring manager who's trying to fill a truck, who says, okay, well, this is how it operates here. And this is, you know, this is how you clock in, you know, I mean, the very tactical. And so I'd say the biggest, most impactful thing was stepping back and realizing we're talking to people. We're people taking care of people that have lots of different reasons that they make a decision of where they want to work. And not that I try to talk people into working for MedTrust necessarily, but I tell them our story and say, if that sounds good to you, if that sounds like something you would be interested in, I'll play quarterback. I'm the founder. I'll play quarterback and connect you to the hiring manager. And I think that personal touch and personal story has allowed us to get our unfair share of a very limited resource. And, you know, we're still very challenged. I mean, in many markets, we're still short-staffed. But compared to a lot of our peers, we're in a better spot than they are. So, you know, it's really, we have 80 ambulances now and 10 wheelchair vehicles and all these markets. But at the end of the day, all of that stuff is cost that doesn't generate any revenue. What generates revenue is people taking care of people. So that's what we focused on. That's what I focus on. And I probably spend 60% of my time doing that. And the other 40% I spend on more strategic things at the payer level or at the state association level or the national association level, speaking on two topics, workplace and reimbursement. Wow. And they're unbelievably tied together, obviously. But that's kind of where my passion is helping in those areas.
That's incredible that you've carved out time to personally speak to not even someone who you've already put through the interview process to say, this person has what it takes and the skill sets we're looking for. And let me bring in the founder then to, you know, introduce myself. You're doing it as the first line.
I'm the first point of contact.
Point of contact. That must blow people away. And I could see why people are so impressed and kind of taken back with that, and why that would, if you're looking at equal pay and equal, you know, geographical opportunity, people would, you know, I would go with MedTrust 10 out of 10 times if I had the chance to hear from the founder, the vision, the philosophy, the future, like what am I getting into that a HR director might not have that background story to share?
Well, and also, I guess two points there. One, you still have to deliver on it, right? Like that's the big piece, right? You can't get this great, wonderful experience and then drop off, you know, through the rest of the process. We have to have a different interaction, you know, from the hiring manager. We have to have a great orientation process. We have to, you know, stay close to our folks during that 90-day period. And so that's kind of the, I guess I'm building the foundation, and that's the sides of the walls and the roof and the chimney. But you can't build the chimney first, right? If they're not there to be hired, then you don't get a chance to do those great things. So that's one point. The other, though, I would say, even if it was a much different engagement than I'm doing right now, the power of having someone that is either very senior to the organization and been around for a long time, or a provider that is unbelievably passionate about the organization, either one of those I think could have a similar outcome. And it's no knock on HR at all. There's so much administrative piece to this. There's so much that they do. But there's really no comparison, I don't think, with either somebody that works there that's happy about it or passionate about it, or somebody that built the thing or is responsible for the thing. So I would encourage all healthcare leaders to really think about flipping where they're engaged in the process. And if you are responsible ultimately for your culture as the leader, then be involved early on and figure out if there's a cultural fit. And then if sure. there is, then turn it over to your folks to determine, you know, the skill set fit, the hours that they'd like to work, the market that they want to be in. I mean, I think you can really lean on, you know, your subject matter experts second instead of first.
Sure.
Because a lot of times we weed people out because of something that's a technicality when they would be your best employee if you just knew, hey, they've got this gap in this particular area, we can train to that, or but they're fired up, they're in the business for the right reason, they're, you know, grandmother was transported by an ambulance and it, you know, turned them on to, I mean, there's all these things that drive why people are doing this work. And it's typically not money, because there's a lot of other things to do
sure.
to make a lot more money or make the same money with a lot less responsibility. Yep. And so you got to find those people that really have the why. And that's why our logo, there's a heart at the middle of a cross surrounded by a circle. And the heart represents the heart for the patient. The cross represents help. Everybody's heard Red Cross. We are the help. Us, the hospitals we work with, all the providers, we're all part of helping. And then the circle, if you've ever been married or been to a wedding, you've heard the unbroken circle of trust, right? And sure. and that to me is about accountability. And that's accountability internally, and it's accountability to the community. And it has to be unbroken. So that's really... that's the story that I tell to someone in that 15 or 20 minutes. And you're right. I mean, I think I have a pretty good batting average, you know, in that conversation, but you still have to execute. At the end of the day, you can tell a pretty story, and
yeah,
you're either a salesperson, or you're somebody that's viewed as really passionate about your company. And it's a fine line.
Sure.
You know, nothing worse than saying, yeah, I thought it was going to be this, and it's not that. And so that's part of the leadership that myself and our executive team and Lena, my partner, current CEO, I mean, it's really about delivering on those promises to our staff and to our clients.
You guys are definitely evolving and evolving quickly and coming up with innovative solutions. You're now almost offering preventative home care services to ensure these people don't end up back in the hospital systems.
Right. Correct.
Wow. Wow. We've learned so much today. Thank you so much, Josh. Let me just look at my notes here to see if there's one more topic we could throw at you before we sign off here. Oh, I did have one question. Talk to me about, you know, organizations that are maturing and growing with the growth you guys have experienced. How important is creating a strategic board members, and what is that selection process like?
Right. So I think it's really important to have a board whose expectation is not to run the company, but to hold the company leadership accountable. So we have a very unique board structure. We have an even number of board members, which is not normally the case, but it's two folks that we felt like could be very additive as we grew. One was a serial entrepreneur with lots of happy exits and lots of experience, you know, as a board member. The other was a former CEO of a couple of public companies. One of them that's actually how he met our CEO. They worked together at a defense contractor that went public and sold to General Dynamics. Wow. And it was kind of, with all of the challenges we knew we were going to face, it was most important to have gray hair / experience in the room. And for us, it was less about having healthcare experience initially. We have some advisory folks that are not on the formal board that are really specific to healthcare. But it was really important for us, especially as we looked at these different strategic ideas, to kind of game them out with people that had probably tried and failed, as well as tried and not failed over their time. But as the company's maturing and even in the hyper growth, I think having board members that are supportive, that are up for the task of hyper growth, is really difficult to find. And we're fortunate to have that. And then transitioning, I'd say we're in growth mode now, but not the same kind of hyper growth. And transitioning into that space with the same board members is also tricky, right? So, you know, we've been fortunate to be unbelievably engaged with our board. We meet with them way more often than some people may meet with their board, both formally and informally. And they're, you know, a big part of where some of our other investors came from, where their relationships, and they're definitely behind us, but they're also have a fiduciary responsibility to themselves and other shareholders. And at this point we have, you know, double digit number of shareholders that are all, for the most part, individuals. But, you know, we take that responsibility very seriously. And, you know, so it's a balance, right? As an executive, you want the free rein to execute on your vision. And as the board, it's their job to make sure that strategy makes sense and doesn't overexpose you from a risk perspective. And I think we balance it fairly well. I do think that as we continue to grow, they'll probably we'll find other ways for folks to engage. Maybe there is an opportunity in the future for a healthcare specific, you know, senior board, you know, senior leadership type person on the board. Sure. But for now, what we've been doing has for the most part been working well. For the most part are headwinds that are really macro level headwinds. And, you know, we believe there's going to be winners and losers and buyers and sellers. And, you know, our focus has just been to build a great company that has the choice to either, you know, be on one end of that equation or the other. And, sure. And our board helps us with those conversations.
So it sounds like your board member has been a good checks and balance system for you and the executive team.
Right.
Make sure you are not taking your eye off of the core mission when these new initiatives come to the table.
Right.
And you found people that might be not necessarily had a long career in healthcare, but have been able to help companies go from your size to the next level and have kind of that experience, which can be converted to really many different industries.
Yeah, I'd say business is business, and folks can say what they want to, and it makes everybody upset, but healthcare is business. And, yeah. You know,
well, I loved what you said earlier. Healthcare is actually a customer service business. You just happen to be in healthcare.
Correct. And I mean, I think profit's often a dirty word in healthcare. And I actually have a talk that I've given on that. Profit's not a dirty word, because I mean, even the Catholic Church says no margin, no mission. And so you have to be able to fund all these great things that are possible. And, you know, that's really the challenge is balancing that and not letting the pendulum swing too far in either direction.
Sure.
But you still got to have a dollar left over. You know, you got to have to keep the lights on and move forward. And that's really what our, you know, our frictional indicator, if you will, is, you know, being efficient, being, you know, successful as a company, and also doing really good work, you know, really good service for our patients. So that's, you know, at the root of it, that's the challenge for anyone in healthcare, I think, and reading Becker's every day and, you know, seeing all of that. I mean, we're all struggling with how to balance that equation right now.
Yeah. Well, Josh, you guys are certainly doing things unconventionally. You're building a business around your people.
Right.
And you're leveling up the expectations and professionalism when it comes to EMS and ambulance services for these hospitals to see that this can be a white glove service, a concierge service, a service where the patients are really the most important thing at the end of the day and providing the premium care that your team is delivering. So I think, you know, everything that you've done from the model and, you know, flushing out data that can be proven with your outcomes to bringing in employees that truly understand directly from the founder what the vision is and what the purpose of, you know, joining this team looks like for them. You know, just everything you've shared with us today leads me to learn that you've done things your own way, kind of right. gone against the grain, and it's proven to be wildly successful. So cheers to you and your team.
Thank you so much. Thank you.
Awesome. You have a wonderful day. Thanks again, Josh.
You too.